You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beauty, sunny, but very, 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 very windy day. But
very
it's spring,
windy.
Don. Well, maybe it's spring. Maybe it's summer. No, maybe it's winter.
It is spring. I think we'll go with spring this time because of the temperature range for the next week, although it's going to be up and down. We just went through a very cool spell last week. Once again, another one. A little bit of rain there a few days ago. We'll come back to that in a moment. As Lois and I are preparing the show for broadcast, today's date is May 8th. 2024, and we're having an extraordinary north wind here, 23 to 25 mile an hour with gusts as high as 38 miles an hour. Breezy, sunny and breezy is the National Weather Service term for this. We're going to go up to a high today of 77, which is warmer than it's been for a few days, and tonight's low is only going to be 58 and clear, 58 and clear. Here's where the weather models diverge a little bit. Day of the broadcast, sunny, 85 degrees. That's pretty pleasant gardening weather. Thursday night, clear, 57 degrees. According to the National Weather Service, Friday, 89 degrees and sunny, of course. Friday night, clear and 56 degrees. And again, the National Weather Service, Saturday, sunny and 89 degrees. And Saturday night, 56 degrees. Some of the other services, such as Weather Underground, have us on Friday and Saturday bumping up into the low 90s. Yeah, 89, 92, something like that is probably where we're going to end up.
And Don, the National Weather Service, when I looked at it this morning, half an hour ago, said it was going to be 91 on Saturday and 91 on Sunday.
There you go.
Think it's because I'm looking at the Davis one and you're looking at the one that's over in Solano County.
I'm looking at Dixon and we're 10, 12 miles to the west, and that will make a couple degrees difference, probably. Also, these, you know, the 2 to 3 degrees difference. I've already had people, you know, oh, it's going to be 90 degrees. Oh my God, it's going to be so hot. I said, no, really, folks, we actually kind of need this. the plants in your garden would appreciate, one, a dry wind to stop all the fungus problems. Two, to get a little warmer in the soil for those subtropical and tropical plants that we like to call summer vegetables. So this is all to the good. And then here's the main thing. The extended forecast has it looking cooling a bit as we go past the hottest days of this little episode, Friday and Saturday. We're looking at, into the low to mid 80s for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week, and even cooling off a little more from that. So the warming trend is for the weekend, and then the extended discussion Sunday through Wednesday. Some uncertainty. There's a ridge out there over the Pacific, range of possibilities, but Saturday and early next week we'll see afternoon highs in the upper 80s and then cooling off mainly 70s and 80s as we get into the later part of the week. That's what it presently says. Looks like that could diverge one way or the other. But dry and windy means some changes in the garden compared to what we've been experiencing. The main thing we've been having up until now is much cooler than we prefer for summer flowers and vegetables, and the soil moisture has continued surprisingly high all the way into May. I have to quickly put this out there. I've already had people asking, well, should I turn my sprinkler system on for the season, quote unquote, for the season? It depends on what you're watering. Obviously, if you've just planted some vegetables, you should probably hand water those every day right now, especially with this kind of dry wind and these higher temperatures. If you have vegetables and things like I do in containers waiting to go in the ground, they definitely need daily water. Check your container plants around the house. You've kind of, you know, not had to water so much for the last couple months. Now they're drying out very rapidly. So going out and watering them and also washing them off, a few aphids might be on there. Good thing to do on a day with very low humidity. Just clean them up and give them a good thorough soaking. Container soils are drying out fast enough that at my nursery, we have already begun basically watering everything in the nursery every day. Those are plants in containers in nursery soil, so they need that. In your garden, oh, things in a barrel might not need every day, but definitely, that's our motto here, check daily, water as needed. And in containers or newly planted seedlings, you probably will need to water daily, especially if we have a couple days of wind and higher temperatures than we've been experiencing. But I want to flip this around a little bit. Go ahead.
I want to remind people that when we say Saturday and Sunday are going to be 91 degrees or 89 degrees, depending on who you talk to. And remember, this is Whole Earth Festival weekend. So we got people, lots of people coming to campus, walking around, and it's going to be hot. Well, think about it. It's only going to be 91 for an hour.
Yes.
Before and after that, it'll be less. And at night, it's in the 50s. So it's like, coming up from the 50s, and we're going to peak at 91, then we'll go back down to the 50s. So it's going to be a great day. And if you don't want to be out here when it's 91 degrees, come in the morning, come in the evening.
Yeah, gardening in the morning is great right now. Early evening is wonderful. And looking at the absolute temperatures, we're going to drop from a high on, this is Weather Underground, so they run a couple degrees higher for whatever reason. A high of 91, 92 Tuesday, Wednesday, dropping down to 81 on Thursday and 79 on Friday. So back to the something not where we were before, but back to cooler conditions. Those are fine. Those temperatures are fine. It was the nights below 50, 37 degrees on Sunday morning. 37 degrees. Okay.
This Sunday or last Sunday?
Sunday. So if your peppers and eggplants were in the ground, they did not like that. I'm sorry to say. Yeah, they'll recover now because it's going to warm up quickly. But this is something to be aware of. But the biggest concern I have, this is unrelated to your vegetables and your flowers and things like that. I was going back through my pictures from May of 2017. In 2019, because I remembered something and I found pictures that illustrated this. It rained in May in both of those years. We had rain in April and we had rain in May. Spring rains happen here in the Sacramento Valley. As I often have to say when we're talking about tree selections and things, flooding is just as common here as drought. And the flooding is the part we forget about. And late season rains, well, they're not flooding necessarily. They are keeping the soil wet into May. And then we tend to warm up very suddenly. And a lot of people go out and turn their sprinkler systems on. If you have a lot of California native plants in your landscape, you're fighting Phytophthora. If you just turn them on to run like they're frequently set, as they are frequently set to run. Right now, native plants might need one thorough soaking a week. And if you're doing more often than that with the soil moisture that we have and that we've had all the way up until now, and then sudden temperatures in the 90s, remember that 90-90 rule for Phytophthora. 90 degrees, 90% humidity leads to or makes conditions favorable for crown rot and root rot infection by Phytophthora cinnamomai, which is our primary organism that causes what we call crown rot. We're getting to 90 degrees. The soil is quite moist. The surface is drying out, and that's where the interface between the soil and the crown is where crown rot happens. That's where the infection occurs. If you have woody plants, primarily California natives, ceanothus, manzanitas, things like that, those natives that aren't valley natives, but that everybody likes to plant, Australian natives can also be vulnerable. South African natives can also be vulnerable. The low water landscape plants, if you start trickling water near their base, well, the soil is still moist, and we're getting up into the 90 degree range, you're inviting crown rot. And the pictures I was looking at, because we had a lot of rain in spring of 2019, in May of 2019, were damaged to a surprising number of species, a persimmon tree that got Phytophthora. I'd never seen that before. That's why I took a picture of it. So examples like that were because of the automatic sprinkler system disease. That's what I call it, the automatic sprinkler disease. Okay, it's a pathogen that's on the wall of your garage. So you think, all right, it's warm. Flip on the sprinklers, and they're probably still set the way the landscaper set them, which is, I don't know, 20 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day, 5 minutes a day, 20 minutes every other day, some bizarre combination of irrigation times and frequencies that we try to talk people out of all the time. So this is a good time of year for us to pitch the idea of once a week watering most of the plants in your landscape. Good thorough watering. Well, we can talk more about that many times during the summer, what I mean by a good thorough watering, but in the case of a tree, 10 to 20 gallons of water for a young tree once a week. Shrubs, 5 to 10 gallons once a week. Perennial plants that are established once a week. The things that need water more often are flowers that annual flowers you might be growing, many of which can be surprisingly deep-rooted, but at least when you first put them in, you probably need to check them every day or so. Vegetables that you just planted. Vegetables like peppers and eggplant and cucumbers, which really struggle if they have any kind of drought stress, it really affects the yield. So those are probably going to need, not necessarily daily, but frequent watering. You have them generally in a separate part of your garden anyway, so they can be kind of on their own schedule. But those woody plants, and especially the low water plants, tend to be very vulnerable to Phytophthora. And when we first get warm and people just turn on their system based on the calendar, not based on the soil moisture or the species that are out there, it leads to problems. And that's where crown rot starts to hit. And usually about the third week of May, which is when I started taking pictures of it, and into June, we'll start seeing the effects of that kind of irrigation on top of moist soil. During the drought years, it didn't happen because the soil was so dry that anything you put on there just wicked away right away. But in this weather, we've been cool, it's been moist, and now we're suddenly getting warm. That, unfortunately, is an invitation to sprinkler timer blight. Let's do a couple of our public service announcement things. Okay. We got a big one coming up.
Well, we got two big ones coming up. The big one I want to talk about is the Whole Earth Festival. Mm-hmm. And that's, as longtime listeners will know, that's something that I have worked on for years and years and years. And this year I wasn't able to help out very much, but it's exciting that it's going to happen. It's this weekend. It's always Mother's Day weekend, which is the second Sunday of the month of May. Mm-hmm. And so this Friday, the 10th, 11th, 12th is Whole Earth Festival. Yay! Okay. Well, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are not able to use the quad where we have held this for the last 50 years. So the university has said you can use these playing fields, and they're big flat green areas along Russell Boulevard. That's Fifth Street. And no trees, but there's a lot of room. In fact, they're as big or bigger than the quad. So anyway, we've moved over there and people are setting up now, and there's going to be all the sorts of stuff you expect from Whole Earth Festival will be there. It just won't be in the usual place. So I encourage you to come, and parking's going to be a little tight. Yep. So you might want to take the bus. You know, something that I frequently do is I go to the nearest shopping center and I park out on the street in front of it. And well, I don't want to take up their parking spaces, but there's lots of room out there. Yep. And then I catch the bus from there and go in. And that way I have no car to deal with, no bike to deal with. Yeah.
If it's out on the front quad on Russell Boulevard, if you're coming in from out of town for this, there is a parking garage right there on the campus, right near the Memorial Union, which you can park in on a metered basis. So you could park there and walk on over. You can't miss the big old tent-like canopies they're already putting up out there. They're quite visible. This actually should be a very good location for it, very visible. For residents of Davis, those of us who know the town, Russell Boulevard is going to be a little more congested than usual for the next 3 days, starting on Friday. Friday, it's noon to 10 p.m., Saturday, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., Sunday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's the Whole Earth Festival.
And if you're trying to get to that parking structure that Don just talked about, you're going to come in something called Howard Way. Mm-hmm. And that's onto the campus. You might know College Park, which is on the other side. They're the same street. They just changed names.
Yeah, don't try and park there.
No, that's a residential area. Okay.
Also, the Jepson Prairie Preserve, I haven't mentioned this much during the spring, but the bloom down there has just been phenomenal this year. It's one of the easiest vernal pools to get to anywhere in the Sacramento Valley. You get on Highway 113 South and just stay on it as if you're going to Rio Vista from Dixon. And at some point, the road jogs off to the left. If you don't jog and go straight, you might want to slow down. You're there. Congratulations, you're at Jepson Prairie Preserve. And they actually have docent tours, although this one is out in the middle of the Delta, nowhere. You can go down there on your own and walk around. There's signs that tell you what to do and what not to do. It can be very windy and cold, even on a day that started warm where you began. I love how on their website, which is on a sponsored, it's naturalreserves.ucdavis.edu. Just look for Jepson Prairie. They mention you should bring a warm jacket. It can be windy and cold even later in the spring. Closed toe shoes suitable for walking in a natural area, and a water bottle, because there basically aren't very many facilities there. Someone just posted some pictures. I wanted to mention this one because someone posted some pictures on a Facebook group. The bloom at Jepson Prairie is amazing this year, as you might expect. Lots and lots of rain. The cool temperature is causing the water to evaporate more slowly, so the bloom is extended. Public guided tours of Jepson Prairie Preserve are held every Saturday and Sunday from mid-March through mid-May. Tours begin at 10 a.m., last about 2 hours. They do ask for a $5 donation per adult, but it's not required, and no reservations are required either. So on the tours, the docents, and I know them, will share information about the ecosystem and give you lots of information. But if you're a photographer, you can just head down there anytime. There's still plenty of bloom going on. But to their point, you're getting close to the Delta. It's always windy in the Delta. Keep that in mind. So if you're coming out of Sacramento and it's a nice breezy morning, it's going to be 30 miles an hour down there. Absolutely beautiful open prairie area and still lots of bloom. And guided tours continue through the middle of this month.
How do you spell Jepson?
Ah, good question. J-E-P-S-O-N. Jepson Prairie Preserve. Vernal pools that have been conserved at the end, not the end of 113, but right where it jogs off to the left and continues on down to Rio Vista. Beautiful area here in the Sacramento Valley. An untraveled part of the valley that people aren't that familiar with.
Well, I want to ask the listeners to brainstorm with me. We have coming up our annual spring fundraising, and that'll be from May 13th to 20th. And everybody who has a show during that time is supposed to talk about why they like this and encourage people to come and support the station. Well, here's my question to you all. What do you think that Don and I should say to encourage people to support the station? In other words, what should we talk about? So here's my brainstorming. If you have suggestions, please email them to us between now and the next time we meet. Yep. And on the next show, we will do something. I don't know what we'll do, but so we'll do something.
DavisGardenShow@gmail.com. Send us a script. There you go. Send us a script to read during the fundraising week here. I want to mention,
Send us a little clip that you've recorded. I'm not guaranteeing we'll use it.
No promises. There you go.
No promises, but we'd love to hear what you have to say.
We do like to mention programming here at KDRT, and there's a show that is coming up. He's done a soft landing, as we call it now, and it'll be airing very regularly, called Classical Excursions. We're going to have a classical music show on KDRT again. His comment about his new program: classical radio programs often focus on well-known light classics and ignore challenging and imaginative masterworks, especially from the rich repertoire of 20th century music, which is very diverse, which results in listeners who are unaware of many wonderful works. So his excursions, this is Greg Latrell, will present short and longer works by famous as well as lesser known composers, with insightful commentary by a composer with years of experience in radio, classical marketing, and music education. It's running at 11 a.m. on which day of the week? Fridays, I guess. Let me double check that before we finish this up. Greg Latrell, new program called Classical Excursions. And just to verify that, yes, Fridays at 11 a.m. is going to be a two-hour program. All, a couple of them in the books already. The building is being refurbished at the moment, so the schedule of live broadcast versus rebroadcast will be a little up in the air for the next couple of weeks. But a brand new program here at KDRT, Classical Excursions with Greg Latrell, adding to our extraordinarily diverse offerings at this little tiny radio station in Davis, California.
And there you have Don Shore foreshadowing. You know, that's what he said he was going to do. He's going to foreshadow.
Shadow, yep. Yeah. And you can go there. Now, music shows only stay for 2 weeks. This is station policy. There are two shows of Greg's already there, so you can go check it out, see what style it is, and that those are available at kdrt.org. Just look on the schedule, and there they are, and there's a hyperlink to his program with the last two episodes still present.
And, you know, if you want to have that show longer, just sign up for our podcast and RSS feed and download it to your own computer, and then you can listen to it anytime you want to.
In the old time. All right, we got a lot to talk about today.
Oh boy, do we have things to talk about, Don. I'm going to go through a couple of questions, and I'll try and keep a straight face. I'll try real hard.
Remember, we're not laughing at you. We're laughing with you.
Hopefully.
You're laughing.
Okay. So a customer comes in and says, I need to pick up a bag of planting mix. And Don says, for your tomato plant? And no, for succulents. Okay. So cactus and succulent mix. No, my mom said to buy planting mix.
Yeah.
No difference.
There is no, well, here, more to the point, there is no standardization of these terms in the nursery industry. So if you're putting something in a pot, we call it potting soil, which is a bit of a misnomer because there's no soil in potting soil, at least in the United States. There is soil. I once said on a Facebook page, there is no soil in potting soil. And someone said, well, I wish to gently correct you. In England, or I guess the whole UK, there are companies that sell potting soil that contains soil, an actual screened, selected, clean soil as part of the blend. John Innes mixes, I gather they're called. There is no company in the United States. I modified my statement. I don't know about other countries around the world. There is no company in the United States that sells anything called potting soil that contains soil. So it's a bit of a misnomer to begin with. potting mix is a more appropriate thing. But the problem is this thing in our industry called planting mix. What the heck is that? Well, it isn't anything specifically. That's the point. It doesn't actually have any specific meaning. Planting mix, does that mean something you put on the ground and turn into the soil to put plants in the ground in a mix of soil and it? Or does it mean something you put in a pot that you're growing just directly in that planting mix? Watch out for things called planting mix. Flip over the bag, read the ingredients. You may find it's really mostly compost. And while I've grown things in really mostly compost, it takes some skill sets. You have to water a lot because the water tends to run through. You have to water carefully. You have to usually add nitrogen, et cetera, et cetera. Generally speaking, those things are intended as a soil amendment. What's a soil amendment? Something you put on the ground to mix in with a native soil and plant into. Bearing in mind that we usually recommend not doing that, first of all, amending the soil for woody shrubs, trees is well established, lots of research. It's not a good practice. It's actually harmful in the long run. Amending the soil for flowers, for young vegetable plants, fine, you can do that. But that's what a soil amendment is, something you amend, i.e. mix in to the soil. I've also come to realize that the word amendment and amending isn't a term or a phrase that everybody immediately knows what it means. It's something you would put on the ground, mix it in with a native soil, plant right into it. That's a soil amendment. What she wanted was a potting mix. It'll probably be labeled in the United States potting soil. Something that's labeled planting mix could have anything in it. But this is an important thing to know. Everything that's in that bag is listed. The ingredients are listed in the order of volume. I believe, yes, volume. And so if you're about to buy something, turn it over and read what's in it. And if you're going to plant something in that as a potting soil or potting mix, and it's going to stay in that for a while, and there's no kind of fertilizer in that soil that you're about to, the soil mix that you're about to purchase, you're going to have to feed a lot more. That may be why it's less expensive than the other bag you looked at, because it doesn't have things added that give, well, added value, as we say in retailing, the added nutrients and so on. So a well-constructed soil for growing things in containers, which we call potting soil or potting mix, will have some kind of organic base, probably peat moss, sometimes coir, some kind of fast-draining component, usually sand, frequently also perlite or pumice, depending on the company and what it's being intended for, and some kind of just compost, which is kind of filler, but also has the advantage of retaining moisture, holding nutrients, and so forth, if you apply them separately. But almost every company now also adds some kind of plant food, some kind of fertilizer. The vast majority of them, despite how it all started with Miracle-Gro Company using their own synthetic fertilizer, the vast majority, including Miracle-Gro, now add organic fertilizers, either dehydrated chick manure, bat guano, seabird guano, kelp meal, things like that are added in fairly carefully calibrated amounts to provide a full season of feeding. And this is important to know. If you're planting a pepper plant in a container and you use a good quality potting soil, you won't need to fertilize it all summer. If you buy that cheap bag of, quote, planting mix, end quote, you'll have to fertilize it every couple weeks or every month, depending on what you use. So there's a big difference in quality. There's a difference in the ingredients. And just flip it over and read it. It's in there. And do look for some kind of fertilizer supplement or some kind of fertilizer source in there. They'll identify it exactly. They'll tell you exactly what it is because they have to by federal law. And so you will know whether you're getting something that's going to provide all those nutrients and whether it has, you know, a good balance of those things that enhance drainage, but also the things that retain moisture and so on. You know, a carefully constructed potting soil is worth the extra money. Something called planting mix, who knows what it is? Probably almost always predominantly just compost. Nothing wrong with that, but it's just compost. So it's not typically something that I'd want to amend the soil with, and it's certainly not something that I would put in a container and grow a plant in. In spite of having done so many times, I can tell you what the limitations are on things that aren't really designed for container growing.
And for those of you who are not all that knowledgeable about what this component is and what that component is, you know, if you're at a nursery, go and ask the professional in the shop. And
if you're at a nursery,
if you're at a grocery store, there's not going to be anybody to tell you what to do. But if you're at a nursery, you can ask questions.
Well, the point is that probably the majority, just so you all know, in our industry, the sales of green goods and their associated products are pretty well split between nurseries and garden centers, which is what I have. Hardware chains or do-it-yourself chains, Home Depot, Lowe's, general merchandisers like Walmart, which is the single largest seller of everything in our industry. I mean, when Walmart sells something, they're the biggest immediately. And so they're the biggest purveyor of plants in the United States, the biggest purveyor of bag goods in the United States. As an example, they're a general retailer with a huge reach. And then the other category is what you just mentioned, the offbeat ones like grocery stores and, you know, the funny places you see plants and bag goods and things like that. Safeway, you know, they'll bring in a pallet of some kind of planting mix and put it out there, and generally a very good price on it. There's nothing wrong with those if you know what you're getting. It's when you buy the $4 bag of something labeled planting mix, take it home, put it in a pot, plant something in it, and then come into me 4 weeks later because the plant is showing nutrient deficiencies. Now, I'm happy to sell you a fertilizer at that point, but we could have made it easier for you. You know, you could have paid more for a good soil that you don't have to water all the time, that holds water a little better, holds nutrients a little better. But to your point, there's a lot of places that sell huge volumes of these things that don't have anyone on staff that's there to answer questions. I don't want to denigrate Lowe's or Home Depot, but they're not primarily plant stores. They're not primarily, not even a, you know, a major category for them, but they sell huge amounts of bag goods and a surprisingly large amount of plant goods. So going and asking someone there, you might get someone who knows, might not, but the good news is it's on the label. Just as every fertilizer that you buy tells you exactly what the source is of the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. You can read about it. If you have questions after you're doing that, that's where you want to talk to someone who knows something about soil science. If you're reading a bag and you're curious about one of the things they put in their feather meal, you know, send us a note. We're happy to talk about these different sources of nitrogen and phosphorus. I just started stocking at my garden center, it's unique to us so far, alpaca wool fertilizer.
Huh.
Okay. There's a
Well, that'll shed water. Alpaca wool, like most wool, has lanolin in it, doesn't it?
Yes, I believe so. I'm not an expert on alpaca wool, but I do know one thing. These, what I'll call byproducts of various animals, tend to be very high in nitrogen. This is 11% nitrogen. There's a local weavers and textile guild, and these are all alpaca folks, and the alpaca manure is a good quality pelleted manure, just like many other forms of ruminant manure. Are they ruminants? I think they are. I don't know anything about animals, but I do know this. Their guano, if you will call it that, is good nitrogen fertilizer. Their wool byproduct is outstanding, just like feather meal is an outstanding source of nitrogen. So we're talking about 11% nitrogen from an animal source that is not just sustainably harvested, gently and pleasantly harvested for the animal. This is not a byproduct of the livestock industry. I'm actually kind of curious with, I have a few customers who are vegan and who don't want to use animal byproducts, that is to say, livestock industry byproducts in their yard. That's one of the reasons.
They don't want to kill the animal to get it.
They don't want to be any part of the livestock industry. I've had these conversations because it's a limited range of fertilizers that would be possible for someone who's vegan. Well, this one, it doesn't harm the animal. They may not want to use it anyway for other philosophical reasons, but it doesn't harm the animal at all to create alpaca wool fertilizer. These are the kinds of things you'll sometimes see on a label as an ingredient. Seabird guano and bat guano are fairly recent additives to potting soils and so forth. If you got a question, send them our way. We're happy to talk about the different nutritional values of different parts of the animal.
So if you have a dog, and you comb your dog and you keep the dog hair, you could make your own nutritional value. Okay, never mind. We're getting a little crazy here now, Don. Let's get back to business.
Just put that in your compost pile. It'll be a great place for it.
Yeah, okay. That'd be good.
All right.
Okay, so the next question that I have, this was a good segue to it. I was told I need a high phosphorus fertilizer for my plumeria to make it bloom.
Oh,
now,
if
let's
it were that.
A plumeria is a tree which grows rampantly in Hawaii, and occasionally at the airport, you'll find a little stick in a bag, and they'll send it home with you, and you can put it in a pot and try and grow it. And if you're really lucky, you can put it outside and try and grow it. But remember, Hawaii is very moist and Davis is very dry. So
the main issue is temperature. And actually, we have a longtime listener who was in Southern California who listened to us talking about how to propagate plumerias a number of years ago.
He sent us a picture.
Yeah,
it was 13 feet tall.
Made me want to go out and throw out my poor little 2-gallon plumeria that I've been nurturing along all these years. Getting them to bloom in Northern California, particularly in the interior of Northern California, can be a challenge because basically every summer they're recovering from whatever injury they experienced the previous winter. They're not hardy enough to grow in the USDA zone 9 or sunset zones 8, 9, 14. You can grow them outside in sunset zones 15 to 24, if you're still familiar with the sunset zoning, or in USDA zone 10, which is coastal strip of California and much of Southern California. It doesn't get cold enough there to injure them. It isn't a lack of phosphorus that was causing her plumeria not to bloom. And I, you know, we addressed this many times. Phosphorus is part of the whole energy transfer process of the plant. It is linked to bloom production because that's a very energy intensive process in the plant. A deficiency, a serious deficiency of phosphorus could prevent a plant from blooming. It also would probably not be growing very much, because when you have a serious deficiency of phosphorus, you probably have a deficiency of everything else too. Applying phosphorus to a plant that has adequate levels in the soil doesn't stimulate bloom. This is the key myth that the horticulture industry has put out there for 50 plus years, to my knowledge, and probably longer, that somehow applying a high middle number fertilizer will stimulate prompt increase or cause bloom. No. A deficiency may prevent bloom, but an increase will not cause bloom. And the best example or best parallel I can give is, if you're deficient in iron personally, you go to your doctor and your doctor says you're deficient in iron, you're anemic, take iron, you'll feel better. You'll feel more perky, you will feel livelier. If you have adequate iron in your system, taking iron will not make you more perky. A cup of coffee will make you more perky. Iron will not make you more perky. So it's if she had a serious deficiency, if a soil test had shown that she had a serious deficiency, applying phosphorus might be the one thing that would get that plant to finally bloom. But probably
it's
not.
It's plumeria. Yeah. It's probably not going to bloom because it's not going to bloom.
Oh, I have customers who have bloomed plumerias here in the
city. I know, but I mean, if she were talking about, tomatoes,
yeah,
and said the same thing about tomatoes, that would be, your answer would be even more relevant. But plumeria?
Yeah, the biggest issue with them, as I say, is they're almost always recovering from last winter's injury. Now, the customer that I had, who had a very successful plumeria in the Davis area, and remember, we're sunset zone 14, it's comparable to sunset zones 8 and 9, Sacramento, Woodland. We are sunset zone 9. She had it, she kept transplanting it as it grew, that's crucial. So new soil every couple of years, she didn't need it more often than that. But by the time I saw this plant, it was about 6 feet tall. And in, if I recall, it was about the equivalent of a 15-gallon, sort of a squat 15-gallon nursery container. And she had it inside, but she had floor-to-ceiling windows and a sliding glass door facing east. Full morning sun in the wintertime. And as soon as it got warm enough, she would often check with me about this. You think it's warm enough to put the plumeria outside? Right about now, sometime in May, it would just go right outside that same window, moving maybe 10 feet, but now it was outside and more sun, but sun only still until about early afternoon, but full morning sun. And then as soon as we got cold, end of October, early November, back it came into the house. She didn't even bother with the whole drying it off, force it into dormancy thing that a lot of you people do in colder climates. She just brought it inside. I told her to wash it off really vigorously beforehand, because you almost always have some spider mites on there and you might have aphids or whiteflies that you don't notice. So a vigorous rinse, check the soil to make sure there's not an ant's nest in it. Once that's all cleaned out, right around mid to late October, it comes back in. But she was only moving it 10 feet. Her light barely changed. So that's the first thing. No big shock to this plant going from outside to in or inside to out. And very consistent light conditions. And she kept it moving, so it kept growing. If your plant isn't growing, it isn't going to bloom. And if it isn't kept adequately transplanted, it probably isn't going to have enough growth to bloom either. So you have just the right place for a plant that's basically subtropical to tropical. And you are careful to protect it from cold in a way that doesn't, you know, so it doesn't get set back each winter. And move it out as early as you can, but not so early that you injure the plant. Hers bloomed, and it was amazing when it did, because it was right by the door, and the fragrance of those is why we all do this. If you live in Southern California, put them out in your yard. If you're in frost-free part of Southern California, they're actually surprisingly drought-tolerant plants, very, very tough, actually. But their issue here is that they tend to get, the worst problem in the valley is cold plus wet. Cold is not great. Wet is not great. Cold plus wet usually rots it right at the crown. You end up having to take a cutting and start over.
Mm-hmm. All right. So one other comment on this particular page. Don collects these up and just shoots them over to me every once in a while. And this one is a quote. It is a direct quote. Are your plants labeled if they're poisonous?
And the answer is no. And I've had this come up more than once. People who want to know about each and every plant as to whether it's poisonous.
Define poisonous, Don. I mean,
well, that's the problem.
Things that I eat all the time that have ate too much of them, I could poison myself.
That's a big part of the problem. If there's a plant that we know is highly toxic, a good example would be lilies, true lilies. I believe that they should be labeled. I think that people who sell true lilies, not day lilies, not Peruvian lilies, not things called lilies, but things in the genus Lilium, which is a very popular florist plant. I absolutely love them. One of my favorite flowers to grow. Highly, highly, highly toxic to cats. As most of us have learned over the years that, you know, we're in the nursery industry or the houseplant industry or the florist industry, even a bit of pollen can be very, very harmful to cats. So in my opinion, simplest thing would be to put a sticker on that pot that has like a cat face and a line through it or something. But, you know, whatever will make it very clear that this is highly toxic because the risk is high. And this is the key element in plant toxicity. The risk is high because it's in your house, it's right there, and cats get up on things. Okay, it's not a risk to your dog, typically. Dogs don't climb on the counter. At least most of them don't. But the cat can get right up there and bump right into the thing, and even a small amount of exposure can be very, very harmful. I don't know that it should be a law or anything like that, but I would have a strong preference that the florist industry and those of us who sometimes sell lilies for indoor decoration should make it very clear this is a significant risk. But not every plant that has some toxin in it is even the slightest risk. And when someone told me recently, one, it should be illegal to sell oleanders in California. Well, look, I wouldn't care if it became illegal to sell oleanders in California. But I said that's a very misplaced concern. The risk of human toxicity with oleanders is practically nil. The cases in the history, cases out there that have happened are so unique and unusual that they're written up. We can find them online and read about the rare cases of oleander poisoning. More to the point, most people seem to know that oleanders are poisonous. And if they don't, well, if we were selling an oleander, if we happen to order one for someone, we always comment, be aware of the risk of oleander toxicity to livestock, to alpacas and other animals like that. There was a horrible poisoning in the Davis area where someone left some branches of oleander where alpacas got at them and they were killed. So that became a messy situation, not to mention a tragic situation. So it's one of those ones that most people know, but she said, it should be illegal to sell oleander. I said, well, I hate to, you know, just playing devil's advocate, should it be illegal to sell Daphne? It's just as poisonous. And most people don't know that. She goes, oh, Daphne's poisonous? I said, no, but most people don't know that. Hellebores are poisonous. The number of plants that are toxic that are a risk is pretty low. It's the indoor uses that are a concern. And so if someone's about to buy a Diefenbachia at my store and they're, you know, pretty commonly they're novices to plants, first thing we'll say as they're bringing it up to the counter is, just curious, do you have any pets or young kids in the house? Because you should probably know that this is a poisonous plant, where the reaction, although they're not going to die, it's not going to be fun. So it's something, whereas the pothos right next to it contains the same active ingredient, but the amount you would have to consume of a golden pothos is something you couldn't do. So it's not a risk. Diefenbachia is a risk. You bite into a Diefenbachia, it's going to be a very unpleasant experience. You bite into a peace lily, as my kids did at one point, made one into a salad and started to eat it. That's when we found them. So we called the poison control people and they said, oh, that contains a little bit of the same active ingredient that's in Diefenbachia. Just monitor them if they get irritated, use a little Benadryl, you know, just keep an eye on it. And that was basically telling us, in so many words, the risk of that same ingredient in that plant is much lower than in Diefenbachia. So what label do we put on peace lily? You know, this is the concern. There's no way to come up with a labeling system. In my opinion, if you're very concerned about this, ask as you go. Particularly with pets, it's pretty easy for us to look online to see the ASPCA list, which is a binary list, just says yes or no, or a much better list at North Carolina Extension, which says contains this, but large amounts would be needed to be ingested to be harmful, or yes, very toxic, be very careful. It gives you actual degrees of risk, whereas the ASPCA list is just yes, it has, no, it doesn't have. I consider the North Carolina approach better, but those are shades of ambiguity, and not everybody likes shades of ambiguity. So you really do have to take it on a case-by-case basis. No, they're not labeled for toxicity. I'll make one more point on this. In our nursery industry, at one point we asked about this, you know, just out of curiosity, what would, you know, asking people outside the industry, and an attorney for the association said, your problem is if you label some things for toxicity, people will assume things that are not labeled for toxicity are safe. So you could be at risk because of your decision to put specific labels on some plants. The best bet is the ones that are really a significant risk, like lilies to cats, for example. Labeling would be great. It would be great if staff at all the places that sell those things would know. Problem again, getting back to a point made early in the program. The vast majority of Easter lilies that are sold in the United States are sold at Walmart, Home Depot, and Lowe's. It's right there, and places like them, the other kinds of stores like them. So training the staff of those places to know that lilies are toxic to cats would be an unpractical endeavor. Getting just a stick-on label on the pot would make more difference than anything. But also, informing yourself about the actual risks and going ahead and learning what are good, reliable sources for cat toxicity, dog toxicity. Talk to your vet about resources they use for animal toxicity. And with respect to people, I consider the North Carolina Extension page to be probably the most useful. One of the things that we run into that always surprises us is people expecting us, staff at a retail garden center, to know whether a plant is toxic to geckos, snakes.
How are you going to know that?
I say I'll be happy to look this up and tell you about cats and dogs, but I would think if it's snakes or things like them, you should probably join the Herp Society and find out from those folks, because they probably have resources that I don't have access to. It is surprising how often people think we're going to know about toxicity to every different kind of animal.
A plant. You should know everything about every plant.
I know whether it contains saponins or calcium oxalate crystals. I can tell you that. What I can't tell you is the exact risk. Okay.
All right, let's go to the mailbag. Laura, who lives in Woodland, writes, I am hoping to get some kind of clear answer to a possibly very bad rose problem. We bought our home 8 years ago, and it came with an established and beautiful rose garden in the center of the backyard. I took to teaching myself rose care and pruning, though admittedly I didn't prune them this past winter. Most of the varieties I don't know the name of, except for one beautiful pale pink one called Evelyn, which I love, as that was the name of the former lady of the house. Oh. My favorite, however, is a stunning deep pink and orange blossom, photo attached, and I have not been able to find the name of this rose. So we'll ask Don for that. Hold on. And horror of horrors, I'm starting to suspect it may have some kind of fatal rose disease. Please see the close-up photo of the warty-looking growth coming from under the splitting bark. In doing some research, it kind of looks like rose crown gall. However, most of the photos I've seen online of this disease, it seems to have the warty growth seeming to surround the cane, whereas what we have here is clearly coming out from underneath the bark. When today I saw that the bark of the Evelyn rose bush had started to have splitting and what looks like the beginnings of the warty growth, further photograph, can you help me figure out what is going on? I love these roses, and if they are failing from age, would like to try to propagate them if possible, but know from my reading that if it is indeed crown gall, that would be pointless. I have struggled to find a definitive answer on this, and that is making trying to figure out how to proceed very hard. If it is indeed that crown gall and has already spread to the roses in this entire bed, is there harm in letting them stay there until they fall completely apart? I have roses a few other places in the yard and can maintain strict hygiene between plants if needed. But if this will be in the soil for years to come, I'm inclined to enjoy the roses every day I possibly can, unless there's a good reason not to. Well, Laura, that's a heavy thing. Well, let's do the light one first. Can you ID that rose?
Sure, looks like Grenada to me. That's my best. I mean, it's a blend. It's an orange-pink blend, and there are quite a number in that category. Rio Samba is another one. The one that's been on the market for a long time that has this kind of orange to pink change in the bloom as it opens out is Grenada, Granada. See if that meets, you know, again, there's probably five others off the top of my head, but that's one that might meet your criteria. Very nice one. It does indeed look like you have gall on this, unfortunately. It's up high on the plant. Yes, this is a good time to take cuttings, just for the record, a very good time to take cuttings. And semi-hardwood cuttings are done in May. I'm about to go out and take a whole bunch and do them on our mist bench. Crown gall, it would not necessarily be present further up on the plant. It's an interesting, you don't see the symptoms at first, but so they do make the comment, the whole shrub is infected, it's soil-borne pathogen, all right? So it's splashing up typically, it's generally lower down on the plant. So generally speaking, the recommendation is dig up the whole thing and the soil around it and dispose of it all, blah, blah, blah. No, I wouldn't do that. I would probably take some cuttings anyway, clean cuttings. In one practice in the industry for many semi-hardwood cuttings has been to lightly bleach them at the time that you'd make the propagation. So that might help with the crown gall, just a weak bleach solution. You take them and you splash them in a 5% bleach solution briefly and then let them dry. No, that doesn't kill the plant, but it should help somewhat with possibly transmitting this bacteria that causes crown gall. It's a slow process for it to really badly harm a plant. This is the thing about it. This is why it can become so persistent and prevalent, is because you can have a plant infected with it for years and the plant seems to grow fine and you're pruning and you're leaving the prunings out there and stuff is splashing from plant to plant. It just gets worse until you finally notice it. I don't see a lot on here. So my inclination would be to prune these a little harder than usual. Try to prune out all of the infected portion. Many references will tell you to wash, you know, clean your pruners with a bleach solution, same one perhaps you're using for the cuttings. And I suppose that probably helps a little bit. Pruning it all out, taking that all away, getting rid of any mulch that's underneath the plants, monitoring real carefully, monitoring your cuttings as they grow into new plants, which you put in a completely separate part of your yard, would be what I would probably do if I was trying to conserve this particular variety. You can prune it out, and it doesn't spread rapidly, and it doesn't kill the plant quickly. So to answer all of your questions, they can stay just fine. Prune out what you see, get rid of it if you can, and consider taking some cuttings now and cleaning those cuttings as they go into the propagation system, which means a light bleach solution. Propagating semi-hardwood cuttings of roses is surprisingly easy. Most roses, many roses anyway, will root quite readily, and they'll do so right now. We do it on a mist bench with warm pads because that gives us very close to 100% success rate. When I've done it like home gardeners, sticking them in a pot full of a fast draining soil or propagation medium, putting a plastic bag over the top to keep it moist during the first 2 to 4 weeks as they're sweating and rooting out, I get maybe 50% take. Okay, 50% is fine. The price is right. You know, you hardly paid for anything there. And you'll find some never root. I've had some varieties that are a real struggle to root. Others like Iceberg, 100% of them will root no matter what you do. And a lot of other roses are somewhere in between. So give that a try. Nice, clean, semi-hardwood cuttings in a separate area and see if you can get the plant going that way. But I would prune it all out to the best of your ability. And no, it's not an emergency. It's just something you want to get all of that out of there if you possibly can and monitor for it. And I think that's really your best approach. There's no treatment for bacterial gall. And I think the whole idea of digging out the plant and the soil and all that kind of stuff, that sounds really old school to me, honestly. If it just seems like cutting it back hard, monitoring, continuing to remove it will probably manage the disease, and it's entirely possible you could practically eradicate it. This would be a case where you'd want to get rid of the mulch, clean that all out. I don't see mulch in the picture particularly, but clean that all out and get down there and look for this on the older wood of other roses that are nearby, but especially this one as you manage it going forward.
So a couple of questions on this. Does this crown gall attack anything but roses? In other words, if I take a blower out there and I blow the mulch away from it and it goes over onto underneath the lilac bushes or something, am I creating a problem with that infected mulch?
Probably not. This is the thing. I can't remember whether this is the same one that gets on to other woody plants in the same family. To me, I think that's the least of the concerns here. Just get those out of there. And when you disperse things, the likelihood of infection, especially if you do it in dry, windy weather, the likelihood of infection, like now, finally doing it now, you're probably not going to be spreading the problem. Now, there's a site I went to that's really interesting. They talk about how the only real method of dealing with gall is physical removal. In other words, digging it all out. They posted a whole long thing, and I'll go through that in a moment. But at the end, they have warning. I recently received, this is someone in the Pacific Northwest, received an email from an outraged reader who insisted that one must dig out all gall-infected plants and leave the big hole that is left empty for 2 years. According to what I have researched, says the author, that is a bit extreme. Yes, gall is infectious. Again, we're talking about the Pacific Northwest here. It will spread easily via touch. However, most extension service research that I have read states that you can replace the soil with new compost or soil and plant another type of plant that is not susceptible to gall. If you take out a rose, don't plant another rose right there. Another option is to dig out the infected plant, leave the hole, then cover that space with plastic sheeting during the warm season. Solarization seems to have some mitigating effects on the crown gall bacterium here in Oregon. Well, hey, if it works there, it'll definitely work here. But color me skeptical on that. I'm not really convinced on soil solarization for anything, but worth a try, I suppose. You can read about it. After about 6 to 8 weeks, says this author, you may be able to replant in that spot. However, there is no way as yet to completely eradicate crown gall. Still, if you're a home gardener, you may not have the luxury of leaving holes in your yard for years at a time. As always, research the topic on solid agricultural extension, i.e. .edu websites. Don't rely on YouTube rants. So,
and that leads into my next question, yeah, which is, we're talking about taking cuttings from a rose and growing new plants for them. Man, that sounds so scary. Is there an extension site that might have a training video on how to do it?
Could
I
be.
Mean, if I just went to YouTube, I'm sure I'd find 1,000 things, but who knows if they're any good.
Well, on propagation, they're actually fine. I mean, I can't think of what would go wrong there, although I suppose I should check them out before I say that. Semi-hardwood cuttings are really easy. You want something that's 12 to 14, 16 inches long. You want at least 2 to 3 nodes, which is the base of where a leaf was attached, to go into the rooting medium. That is to say, whatever you've chosen to root them in. In our case, we use a mix sometimes of perlite and vermiculite. Sometimes it's potting soil with pumice, depending on what we're rooting. Both of those work fine. My mother used to use sand, and that works just fine as well. Something that retains moisture but drains fast, so you're going to water it a lot, but you want those roots to be able to push out into something fairly loose. The rooting hormones make a huge difference in the success rate. These are powders that you can buy. Rootone brand is probably the best known, but there are others, where you just open the bottle, you take your cutting, you dip it in that so that at least one of the nodes is coated with what looks like flour, and you just stick it right into your pot. At our garden center, we have taken to doing anywhere from 6 to 12 cuttings all in one 1-gallon container. Okay, now that seems like a lot, but for the initial part of this process, we're just cramming them in there, putting them on a warm table, that is to say that has a heating pad, under a mist bench, and we're leaving them there under that mist bench until they start to bud out and grow, which is typically 4 to 6 weeks. That we immediately take them out so they're not all smashed together and start potting them out once they show some signs of root growth. That's what we do because we're limited for space, first of all. So we're not trying to do, we don't have room to do 150 rose cuttings any other way than this rather high density approach, but it works. Semi-hardwood cuttings are what you're looking at. So if you want to look something up, propagating roses from semi-hardwood cuttings is what you type into the Google search box, and have fun on YouTube. Let us know what comes up. If they have you using anything that isn't normal, banana, don't water, do whatever, don't do it. Don't, or, you know, get back to us. We'll talk about whether it's, yeah, harmful, harmless.
It's like you know, you're gonna root something. Well, you could put it in water. You could put it in soda pop. What? Yeah. Soda pop? Water? What?
Yeah,
no, you want to put it in something that's planting soil.
And putting in water is actually a fun thing to do with house plants. Rooting things in directly in water so you can watch the roots form. Golden pothos, African violets are done that way. All kinds of house plants and things can be done easily just in water. But I've got to say this, when you do woody plants in water, it doesn't typically work real well. If it does, those roots are rather poorly attached and fragile. Yes. So as you take them out, they tend to break off. I really do recommend for shrubs and other woody plants like that, rooting directly into a fast draining medium designed for the purpose of propagation. When I worked in the Botanical Conservancy, it was 50-50 perlite and vermiculite. Sometimes we would use peat moss instead of one of those things. But something that's naturally kind of sterile, this doesn't harbor a lot of organic stuff, and something that is fast draining but retains moisture and so on, that the plant can root into quickly. You don't want a lot of nutrients, you don't want a lot of compost, you want something that's more or less naturally sterile. That's why we use things like 50-50 peat moss and perlite or that kind of thing. You can buy propagation media, or if you really in a pinch, you can use regular potting soil mixed 50-50 with perlite, sand, something like that to enhance the drainage.
One of the other questions that we got, which I think might follow on well here, it says, I'm looking for rose that I can grow in a pot. Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose you could grow just most any rose in a pot, except to get awfully big if it was a big rose.
I had a customer who did all of her roses in containers, and every one of them was in a half barrel. Wine barrel or half whiskey barrel. These wine barrels hold about 3 cubic feet plus of soil, so she didn't have to water every single day. She could water about every other day. An established rose bush has an extensive root system. It's not going to last in a 10-inch pot or a 12-inch pot. So what I suggested to this person, which she thought was very amusing, is I said, head on over to Trader Joe's, or your other favorite grocery store, keep an eye on their florist section, because they bring in miniature roses, and miniature roses are great in containers. There's a whole series that's on the market right now, and I don't know which company is putting these out, but they're when you grow them in the garden, they turn into 2 to 3 foot shrubs with little flowers that are about 3 inches in diameter. They're perfect little rose blossoms. Some of them are fragrant, some of them aren't. They're brightly colored. That's why they chose them for these marketing programs. And you'll see them at Trader Joe's right next to the split-leaf philodendron and the African violets, as if they're gonna be houseplants. They're not houseplants, they're terrible houseplants. They don't work indoors. Let's get that out of the way. So growing roses indoors doesn't work, but they make excellent container plants because they're relatively small plants. They're compact growth habit, and their root systems would be fine in, let's say, a 10 or 12 inch pot, although you will find they're drying out very quickly in that. Maybe something broader, 14 to 16 inch diameter, 12 to 14 inches deep. You could grow a small miniature rose, as we call these, in one of those for a number of years, as long as you provide it with the watering and nutrients that it needs. Regular rose bushes in containers, way too big. It's something you do because you have to, not because it's a preference. And they need, like tomatoes, like other big plants, at least 1.5 cubic feet of soil. And in the case of a regular rose bush, like a hybrid tea rose or a floribunda, 3 cubic feet of soil would make your life a lot easier. The lady who had 30 of these around her backyard, which was quite spectacular, by the way, used to hand water them. Every other morning, she'd go out there and hand water every one of those barrels. And that was what they needed, because they were big plants that were drying out. They were practically root bound. They were drying out just about every day. We ultimately put in a really simple drip system for her, which she finally acknowledged that maybe she needed a little help getting these things watered every day. So we ran a 1/2 inch drip line behind the barrels. Up into each barrel went a 1/4 inch tubing. On each one was a little thing designed for this purpose. It squirted out a little bit instead of just dripping. So it was a little mini sprayer. And she could turn that on for a matter of just 5 or 10 minutes. She figured it out. 5 or 10 minutes, water would start to come out the bottom of the barrel. So she knew she was watering thoroughly. She could do that every other day. It didn't take that much water, but it gave them what they needed. So she's put it on a really simple timer. It wasn't even an electronic timer. It was just a battery operated one is what she used. And you can buy these. You can even get mechanical ones that you just set for 20 minutes and walk away. And that took care of all of them. So it's pretty easy to water container plants and even put them on a mechanical or automatic electronic timer if that's what you prefer to do. But be aware that anything in a container in the Sacramento Valley, interior Southern California, East Bay here in California, or similarly dry climates is likely to need water almost every day. And the more root bound the plant gets, the more likely it is to need water every day. And if they go dry, the consequences will be fairly drastic cosmetically. So a rose that dries out in a container, the leaves all scorch. Yes, it'll recover if you get water to it, but it looks pretty rough for a few weeks. So figure out how you're going to keep it watered. Make sure you have a sunny enough location. Even better, do a miniature rose. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.